Hi, everybody.
She's probably in the hospital, yeah.
Those online, please let me know if you can hear me. That'd be helpful. So today, it's a great pleasure to have Simon Gagné come to us from the New Jersey Institute of Technology. So Simon did his undergraduate Bachelor of Science in Biochemistry, Cellular Biology, and Physiology in France, I guess in Toulouse?
Bordeaux,
oh, okay. It doesn't say on here where the locations are. It just says France.
Yeah, it does. Well, it's, yeah.
Okay, and then he did a Master's in Neuroscience, Behavior, and Cognition at University Paul Sabatier.
That's Toulouse.
And then he did his PhD with Guy Terrelets, again in Toulouse, before coming to Princeton, and it was a postdoc in my lab from 2009 to 2012. And then since then, he's been a professor at New Jersey Institute of Technology, and recently now heading a forensic science institute at that.
It's not true. It's a lie.
So it's a great pleasure to have you here today. And
thank you, Ian. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Just a word of warning before I start. I just came back from vacation. I don't remember what I put exactly in that slide. So it might run longer, it might run shorter, it might have some surprises. We'll see. Okay? All right. So before I start, my lab studies a lot of different systems usually. We go from unicellulars like slime mold, then recently we had actually published a paper on elephants. So we sort of do the entire scale of the animal kingdom. But today, instead of giving you a snippet of what we do in this different area of work that we do in my lab, I decided to tell you actually a story about a single system, right? A single story about this system, which are army ants, and we'll discuss them a little bit more later. Some of you might know about them, some of you might not. And the reason I want to focus on that system is that over the past like 10 or so years, we've been little by little starting collecting interesting information about how these ants are capable of building structure out of their own bodies. And we are starting now, after about 10 years, to get a sort of sense of the general picture of how they accomplish these different feats. Okay? Now, the story starts with a very inspirational quote, right? Life is a game of Lego. And what I mean by that essentially is everything is life. Is built from something, from subunits that assemble themselves to form larger units that themselves assemble themselves, etc., all the way to the formation of fully functional organisms like you and me. Okay? And generally speaking, all of these steps of assembly are done through a process of self-organization. I don't need to explain to you what self-organization is, but essentially everything from the formation of macromolecules to creation of an entire organism can be done through mechanism of self-organization, which when you couple with natural selection, when you couple them together, give you access to that very wide variety of shapes and form, which have one thing in common, is that they're all alive and they're all functional. Right? They're capable of surviving in an environment, adjusting to changes in this environment, and functioning properly from reproduction to death. Now, one thing that is maybe less often thought about as one extra level of this is what some people refer to as the superorganismal level, right? So the level above the organisms. And above, most of the time when we talk about superorganism, we're thinking of, I don't know, a colony of ants, a flock of birds, something like that, where we have organisms coming together and moving, or organizing themselves. But we rarely think of them as something that looks like a functional structure, in the sense that, for instance, these sawfly larvae are, where they are physically interacting with each other, connecting to each other, in order to form this sort of moving slugs that allow actually the larvae that are at the top to move larger distance at less energetic expenses, essentially using same mechanism as the caterpillar of a tank. Okay? So this is an example of what I will refer to as superorganism or a self-assembling structure. There are other examples of these self-assembling structure in nature. You might have seen this, especially if you live in the US like I do. Every year on the news, when the floods hit Florida or Texas, we get these footages of fire ants, which are self-assembling, attaching to each other to form these floating rafts allow them to escape the flooding and survive until the water recesses. And this self-assemblage is extremely functional. You can see that they're extremely buoyant. It's really hard to sink them. And in some places, they will be formed of thousands and thousands of ants. I think the one at the bottom left here is a ball of 8,000 ants drop into water that self-assemble in a floating raft. Okay? So these are functional structure. This is another one. This is probably one of the most beautiful you can find, which are Himalayan giant honeybees. And these are swarms that are formed on the side. I mean, these are like the actual nest, if you want, of the colony. And they form these beautiful shimmering patterns, organized shimmering patterns that are, which function is to actually scare off predators, in particular these giant hornets that are trying to attack the colony. Now, if I remember correctly, yes, all of these superorganisms, all of these self-assembling structures are nothing, or at least I think they pale in comparison to what these guys, which are army ants, Eciton, I think these are the Hemetum one. You confirm Hemetum, good. Which are ants that are forming colonies that can be up to 1 million individuals and will build structure that can contain pretty much all of the colony at once. So we're talking about structures that can form, that can be formed of millions of individuals. And they are formed for a particular purpose, or multiple purposes. One of them is protections. What you see here is what we call a bivouac. It's a temporary nest. And it's a temporary nest because these ants have a very particular trait. They're very weird among all the ants. I'm going to pass on all these weird traits that they have, but one of them that is very important for the story today is that they are nomadic. And what I mean by nomadic is that during certain phase of the reproductive cycle of the queen, they will pack up the entire colony, move it 200-300 meters into the tropical forest, reassemble that massive structure that you see, and then during the day, they will forage from that structure. And then at night, again, pack up everything, move, and reassemble somewhere. All right, to give you a sense of scale, what is a, how big is Munich? 1 million inhabitants, something like this? It's like Munich packing up, moving 30 kilometers, reassembling itself, and every night doing this. Okay, I use Philadelphia in the US, but I don't know if that's going to talk to you here. But right, so they are nomadic, and because of that nomadism, there are things they can't really do, right, or that are not really efficient for them. One of them is they can't build permanent nests. Right? It makes no sense to dig up a nest into the ground, make a permanent home if you want, if you're going to abandon it every night. This, by the way, if you're looking for books to buy for Christmas or any opportunity, this is a book by Walter Tschinkel about ant architectures. Walter does these wonderful casts of ant nests, a lot of fire ant nests actually, and lots of these beautiful examples of this underground construction that you can usually associate with ants. But army ants can't do that because that would be a waste of time. Another thing that they can't do is organize or engineer the environment like these leafcutter ants. What you see here, all that part that doesn't have any grass has been cut out by the army, leafcutter ants, and is maintained like this to form this sort of superhighway along which these massive colonies that can be up to 20, 25 million individuals will essentially use these very well-maintained highways to go forage for leaves, bring them back to the nest, the central nest. Obviously, if you're an army ant and you migrate every day, there's no point in trying to build a road network around your nest if you have to abandon it every day to move to a different place. Now instead, the army ants, this is an example of a swarm of army ants moving through the tropical forest. So the army ants we're talking about, the Escitons, are usually found in Central and South America. If you want to talk more about this, you have Edward here, who is a specialist of them, despite the fact that he pretends to be a bat specialist now. But these army ants, they walk through this very complicated terrain, very complex terrain. Because they're migrating every day, they can't predict which kind of terrain they're going to walk on. And because they are not investing in manufacturing or changing their environment to facilitate their movement, they have to come up with different ways of optimizing or facilitating their movement through this very complex and unpredictable terrain. And the way they do this is they have actually developed a number of morphological and behavioral adaptation that allow them to essentially attach to each other in ways that are extremely, extremely secure and robust. You can see this is an extreme example by this picture by the wonderful Alexander Wilde. where these ends can attach by simply almost like a finger, if you want, on one end and be held in place by other ends at the bottom. And they can do this and stay in these positions for hours without spending too much energy because all the weight is essentially distributed on their exoskeleton. So that's a good thing. If you're Ironman, you can put all your effort on the exoskeleton. You don't need to any muscular forces to sustain extreme weight like this. Okay, so by doing this, by being able to attach to each other like this, they're capable of constructing temporary structures like these bridges, for instance, structures that will be extremely dynamic, that can adjust to their environment, that can self-repair when they break, and that are, as I said, extremely dynamical in the sense that they are built where they are needed, and once they are not needed anymore, they disappear. They are disassembled by the ants. And that move on to the next stage of their foraging. Okay? And so what I want to talk about today is about these construction that the ants are doing. How do they self-assemble? How do they build these structures? And this is a work that I say we have been doing over the past, I mean, I guess it depends if we go back to the origin experiment was probably 20 years, but I've been involved in it for about 12 years now. And this is a work that is work done by a lot of different people, so I want to acknowledge them here. Edward, you're somewhere in there. Every time I look at that list, I think I forget someone because it keeps growing every time I do the presentation. So I hope I didn't forget anyone this time. But you can see these are people that have been, in red are people that have been through my lab directly. In black are people that are collaborators outside of my lab. But there are people that are coming from multiple continents, all the way to Australia, and multiple universities and institutions. Now, the way I want to approach that story today, I want to approach that story from an ontogenesis point of view. What I mean by this is, usually when we talk about collective behavior, we either study a lot or we have a lot of papers on how they are evolved, their function, etc. There's also a lot of papers on the immediate causes, so the mechanism by which they attach to each other, these things like this. But we rarely looked at this structure from an ontogenetic point of view, that is from how they develop, how they maintain their homeostasis during their life, however short it can be, and how they end up disappearing and dismantling themselves. Okay, and so I want to approach that in that talk, in that way. Now, I want to be clear that we didn't do the studies in that order, right? We actually started with the end before doing the beginning and finishing with the middle. And I'm going to also not exactly follow that path in my presentation. But I want you to remember that the idea here is try to figure out, can we come up with a general model of how they go from constructing themselves to maintaining their function during their life and then finally disappearing. Okay? If you are big on ontogenesis, you're like, well, where is the reproduction aspect here? Shh, we're not going to talk about that. Okay? So let's start with the development. How do they emerge? How are they created? And this is actually a study that we published last year. So it's, as I said, we started with the beginning, but that was actually one of the latest study that we've published recently. It's work with Matt Lutz, who was here for a time with Ian. And it's a very beautiful study that we've done in the tropical forest of Panama on BCI, Barro Colorado Island. Now, everything I'm going to show you is all field work. You can't really take these ants and bring them to the lab. It's really complicated. So everything you're going to see, all the experiments is coming from the field. So keep this in mind. This is actually extremely hard work. It looks like beautiful and simple, but to get that going, sometimes you have to wait a week before you find the right trail of ants, that they want to cooperate with you, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a lot of hard work that's been done here by Matt Lutz and Chris Reed. So the experiment is very simple. It's an experiment in which the ants are crossing a platform, and in the middle of that platform, we have another platform that we can tilt at different angles. So we can keep it completely flat to mimic them working on the flat terrain, and we can tilt it all the way to 90 degrees to mimic, for instance, them walking along the side of a tree trunk. Okay? So very simple experiment. And these are some of the first results that we got that shows that essentially as you increase that angle, so as you tilt the angle and the platform becomes more and more vertical, At the beginning of the experiment, which are these sort of greenish-bluish box here, the number of ants that are slipping off of the platform or falling off of the platform is increasing with the angle, which essentially tells us that it's becoming harder and harder for the ants to walk on that surface. Makes sense, right? But if you wait about 10 minutes at the end of the experiment, which are these yellowish boxes here, you can see that that number gets drastically reduced. So at the beginning, it's hard to walk on the platform, and at the end, it becomes easier. And the reason for that is that these ants build across that platform. So here you have the steepest possible platform at 90 degrees. They start building what we call here scaffolding. Essentially, some of the ants are attaching and coiling themselves into the substrate, allowing other ants to cross the platform faster and with more ease, and in particular, prevent them from falling off of that platform. Okay? And so what we saw as well is that if you look at the size of that platform, so the number of ants that are forming that scaffolding, or the density of ants in this case, that density of ants matches pretty well the difficulty of walking on the platform. So the more difficult it is to walk on the platform, the bigger the scaffolding that the ants are going to be building, which essentially led us to a very simple conceptual model of how the ants are deciding where to build. Essentially, when an ant comes into a contact of a substrate, if that substrate is difficult to walk over, if there's a lot of constraints on their movement, that's going to increase the probability of joining in that structure, that support structure that they are building along the trail. And as they do this, they increase the surface area of that support structure, making it easier for future ants to walk on the platform, which in turn reduces the constraint of movement and reduces the probability that ants are going to cross the platform again. Right? So it's a very simple stimulus. It's very hard to walk where I am. I don't need to get any information about anything else in the environment. If it's very hard to walk where I am, I just stop, anchor myself, and that helps the others to pass above me. Make sense? Easy? Everything is going to be easy. I'm not going to show any math today, I promise. I don't understand half of the math that we put in some of these papers anyway. All right, so Matt and Albert Cao and Chris Lustre in Australia took this simple principle, put it into a mathematical model, which you can see the results of here. So in red, what you have is the prediction of the model, that simple model, where you adjust essentially your probability of joining in the structure based on the difficulty to walk in. And what you see in blue are experiments at different difficulties. And you can see that the model matches pretty well the experiments. More importantly, if you look at what the model predicts in terms of how ants are going to fall off the, whether the ants are going to fall off the platform more or less often, you can see that the model here in blue reproduces exactly the prediction, or predict the probability of ants falling very closely to that we get into the experiment. So we have a model, and just to make it clear, this is not inputted in the model, this is an emergent property of the model. So it's a good way of verifying that the model that we have created is actually a good representation of the behavior that we're observing. Right, so that's the development, that's the first piece. It's very easy, it's hard to walk, you stop, it's easy to walk, you continue. And we can then move on to how this ends, right? So as I told you, I'm not going to follow the timeline. I'm going to go directly from how we build to how we deconstruct. And this is actually our oldest study, so, right? So we have done everything in the wrong order, Ian, I think, in that case. This is a very simple experiment, even simpler than the previous one, because we don't even do, we don't have an experimental platform. The experiment is just you go into the forest, you find these naturally formed bridges, you take tweezers, you destroy the structure, and then you let the structure rebuild itself. Okay, so that's a study that Edward participated in. You got bitten enough with that?
Yes. I did the experiment. Yeah.
You did that one, but then Edward went to do the second batch 10 years later.
That's how long ago it is. I did the experiment.
Yeah. You did the experiment in what,
2002?
Yeah, 2002, and then Edward went back in 2009 or 10 to finish the second batch. So it's a very simple experiment to destroy. You look at the reconstruction process. So here are the graphs. The black line just shows you where we destroyed the structure. And then you can see that within Within about 30 seconds, the traffic on the bridge is restored. So the function of the bridge is restored in 30 seconds. Okay. I know this joke is not, I always make that joke here about the bridge in New Jersey that was interrupted by accident. Only the Americans will know about this one, but a former governor of New Jersey decided to do an experiment by completely blocking off the most important bridge between New York City and New Jersey. That didn't go well. It took hours and hours to restore traffic between Fort Lee and Manhattan. But the ants are capable of doing this in 30 seconds, right? So it's a very, very functional structure, very fast to build. And that construction, right, oops, sorry, follows the same rules as we discussed before, right? Here it's not measured in terms of platform angle, but it's measured in terms of the packing fraction of the bridge. So how many ants are essentially filling up the gap that the ants have to cross. And you can see that as you increase the packing fraction, the probability that ants are joining is going to go down, right? So as the constraint of movement decreases, the probability that an ant join decreases. So it's exactly the same thing, right? So it's good because we have two different experiments with two different type of environment and two different types of structure, a bridge and a scaffold, but the same principle applies in terms of the construction. It's a constraint of movement that decides the construction process. Now, the second part that's maybe most interesting for the deconstruction part is how much time do ants, once they have joined the structure, that little bridge, how much time do they stay there? And this is Tucker Murphy that I think spent countless hours in front of the screen, literally counting how many ants were walking over a given ant in the bridge to estimate how long an ant decides to stay in the structure as a function. It was also a Winter Olympian, right? For the Barbados or something like this.
Carrying the flag for Barbados.
Yeah. Winter, like there's only, well, there are only two of them, I think. I saw a picture of him carrying the flag, and there's him and another guy. Yeah. But it's pretty impressive, nonetheless. So as you can see here, the more ants, the more traffic there is passing over an ant, right? The longer the ant stays. Actually, where we fit here and the best fit that we get is with an exponential curve. If you know anything about exponentials, that means that if you keep increasing that value, if the traffic of ants gets bigger, potentially they can stay indefinitely, the ants can stay indefinitely inside the structure. Of course, it's not what happened. The flow of ants at some point dies down. But what's interesting also with an exponential, it means that if you go back in that direction, so if an ant experiences a lot of traffic, probability of leaving is very low. But as soon as the traffic diminishes, very quickly, the probability that you leave the structure increases, right? It's the inverse of that function, if you prefer. Does that make sense? Right, so it's a good thing with an exponential. Technically, it can get you to infinity, but also very quickly, it can go back to zero. And what that means, if we go back to our little conceptual model, is that the decision of leaving the structure is completely controlled by the traffic. Or if you prefer, it's completely controlled by how much usage the structure has. If the structure is used a lot, there's a lot of end traffic on that structure, then the probability of exiting the structure for the ants inside the structure is very low, and the bridge maintains its function for a long time. Conversely, as soon as the end traffic goes down, for instance, at the end of the day, at the end of the foraging, or if the foraging trail leads to nothing and we have to abandon it, very quickly, the bridge is going to dismantle itself. So the structure is only present when it is needed, and when it's not needed anymore, it disappears extremely quickly. Okay? And this is the experiment that Edward did. It was a very simple experiment where him and a colleague went and interrupted traffic. It was you or it was Albert who did that?
It was Albert.
That was Albert.
And Matt.
And Matt. It was Albert and, yeah, Matt was there as well. Jeez, it's so long ago, I don't remember who was in the field. But it's an experiment where essentially what you do is you interrupt the traffic and then you look at how fast the bridge structure reacts to that interruption in traffic. And what you have here is a correlation plot. And you can see that the maximum correlation for both the experiments and the simulation of the model have a correlation maximum at zero, meaning that the bridge reacts immediately, almost instantaneously, to changes in the traffic. Okay? So extremely reactive structure. So structure that builds itself very quickly when it's needed, and that's going to destroy itself very quickly when it's not needed anymore. Now, one of the interesting side effect of that behavior, that reactivity to traffic, is something we observe in an experiment here that was done by Matt as well and Chris Reed again, where we are seeing the ants from the top, right? You're looking from the top down. So the ants are on an absolutely horizontal surface. But we force them essentially along that trail, we force a deviation along that trail. So we force them to take a longer pass. And as you can see at the tip of that deviation where they can cross directly, they're going to start forming a little bridge. And one of the properties of the movement of the ants make that there will be more traffic toward the inside of the bifurcation and less traffic toward the outside. If you prefer, it's easier to cross on the inside. It takes longer time to go on the outside. So relatively speaking, there's more traffic inside the bifurcation than outside. And what that does is, if you remember the model, less traffic on the outside, it deconstructs. More traffic on the inside, it constructs itself. And as a result of that, it looks like the bridge is progressively moving and shortcutting that deviation little by little. Okay? So it's a nice little side property of that deconstruction behavior is allow them also to form suspended bridges that are longer than the length of a single ant sometime. And that will allow them also to optimize and shorten shortcutting deviation along that trail, naturally speaking. Make sense? Right, I don't know what comes after that. Okay, we don't have the end of that story, but I think we only have 35 minutes. So I'm gonna go to the last part, which is how do they maintain their homeostasis? And this is actually the latest study that we published. And this is work that was done in particular by Helen McCreary, who was at Harvard and now is with Albert Kao at Boston, no, University of Boston.
University of Boston.
Yeah.
University of Massachusetts.
Yes, one of the Bostons. There's so many universities there. But essentially, the goal of the study that Helen did with us was as follows. Like, this is an example of a natural bridge. Again, a picture by Alexander Wild. And as you can see, the structure on which it's built, it's simple dead leaves, right? So it's a type of substrate that is not exactly extremely stable. A little bit of wind can make them shake. Just the weight of the ant itself can then change the geometry of the gap that they are crossing. So it's a substrate that is not extremely stable over time, that can change over time. And the question that Helen was asking is, how do the ants react to that? Dynamic substrate? And how do they maintain their function despite the fact that the substrate they're attached to is dynamical? And we already saw that video, but that's the experiment that Helen did. And it's a simple experiment, right? So it's, again, this platform where the ants are moving. If you remove the green screen, it's a tropical forest behind, so this is not lab again. And then every 30 seconds, we increase the size of the gap by a millimeter. And we do this until the gap is about 3 centimeters long. And after that, we shrink again from 3 centimeters to zero. Right, so the idea is we give them a dynamical substrate, and then we observe the behavior of the ants to try and understand how do they manage to keep the bridge functional despite the environment changing around them. And so these are the results. So as I said, this was published at the end of last year, if you want to see the paper. And I'm not going to look at all of them, but because they all sort of tell the same story, but we can, for instance, just focus on the number of ants in the structure. And what you can see here is two different curves, one orange curve and one green curve. The orange curve corresponds to the part of the experiment where we increase the size of the gap. Okay, so I'm going to call this the expanding phase. And the green curve corresponds to the phase where we shrink the gap. Okay, and I'm going to call this the contraction phase. And one thing that you can notice is that the dynamic of the construction process, so the number of ants inside the structure, or the volume of the structure, or all of the other metrics that we have, follow a different dynamic during the expansion of the bridge than during the contraction of the gap. Okay, and that's if you do a little bit of dynamical systems, you probably heard that word. It's an hysteresis, right? It's a delay. There's a delay in between the cause and its effect upon a chain of direction of the cause. Here, the cause is the size of the gap. Right, and the effect is the number of ants or the volume of the bridge. And as you can see here, it constructs at a certain pace. But as soon as we start shrinking, it takes a little bit of time before the bridge reacts and finally deconstructs itself. Does that make sense? I mean, I'm pretty sure everybody has knows about hysteresis here. Yes?
What happens to all those things fall down?
Oh, they're fine. They have an exoskeleton, so they fall on the ground. And then,
I know that you fall and they fall. Where do they go after?
Oh, I mean, they. You have to imagine. I mean, if we were in this room and you have a swarm of ants here, right? They would be everywhere in this room. So they fall. They will find the nearest trail, and then they will just rejoin the traffic on their trail.
But if a sectional colony does become isolated, like with rainfall or something, they will form a mill where they'll just each follow each other's trails.
Yeah, that can happen as well.
Spiral of death. Sometimes people call it, and then we'll just walk around until they run out of energy and die. So that's very rare,
Yeah, and it happens like on like concrete, like on very unnatural,
very
uniform. Yeah, you need essentially you need that situation in which you can't break the symmetry of the system anymore. But they're fine, and even if all of these workers are sterile, right? So they don't participate. Their job is to help the colony get the resources necessary to grow the next generation. But if you lose, these colonies are sometimes a million individuals. If you lose 1,000 of them, the colony is not going to feel it. It's like you, if you scratch yourself, you're going to lose some skin cells. You're not going to die out of this.
Then why do you care about the bridges falling at an angle? Because the typical falling rate is around 1%, 2%. Is that a big number?
So.
Because the number
it's not a question of whether they are falling out of the platform. Is you know the falling out of the platform is a measure for us of how difficult it is to walk. So if it's difficult to walk on the substrate, it means you're losing time crossing that substrate, right? Because if you fall and then you have to climb back up and follow the trail, it's all time lost. So
and
if you have a mechanism,
prey lost as well, Sam. And prey loss.
And prey loss, right? So that's one.
Yeah.
There's that, and it's also very important. They swarm. Their preys, right? So they you've seen in some of the videos, they attack preys that are much larger than them sometimes, and they need to swarm them. So they need a lot of workforce. And so any percentage of workforce you lose along the way, and then here we're talking about one bridge or one platform, there is hundreds of them along the trail. So if you lose like 1% at every bridge, at the end, there's nothing left.
And just a second.
Yeah.
People in the joining by Zoom asking to repeat. Oh. The questions because
So the question was repeat the question because the question was what does it matter
if any 1% losing each time at max, what's the big deal at 1%? Considering you just said skin cells getting away.
So. Yeah. So the question I don't know if I understand. So the question was, so we have these ants falling off the trails or falling off the platform, for instance. And so it's not a big deal because they can go back into the traffic, et cetera. So they doesn't seem like a big loss. And it's true. For any given portion of the trail, it's not a big loss. But if you compound this over the entire trail, then you can end up with significant loss in terms of productivity, if you want. I don't know what the tradition is here. I can answer a question live. I'm fine answering live. If we don't finish the slides, we don't finish the slides.
So my question was, what is the limit in terms of the size of these bridge structures?
Okay.
Because I can see it either being mechanical, where you can only the mechanical limitations, or is there the sort of ant hours spent in a bridge, is there some point where the cost of that lost effort?
So So the question was, is there some sort of like first physical limit to these structures? And I'll come to this a little later, but the answer is not really. I mean, in the bridges, we managed to get bridges that were up to 14 centimeters long. I think that's the longest one that Matt and Chris managed to build. But there is like every year you have this video that pops up on social media of that gigantic sort of festoon of army ants, which is probably a maladaptive. We can discuss how that happened, but that thing is made of thousands and thousands of ants. I mean, it looks like a big island of ants. So the structure can be pretty big, and I'll show you some data later on recent work that we've done that's not published yet, where the way they build actually, technically, there is no limit to how big they can build. Okay, that's the first thing. The second question you had is, is there a moment where it's not worth building anymore? Because obviously, for the same reason that if you have ants trapped in these structures, these ants are not available for foraging. If you have too many of these structures, at some point you're going to have a significant portion of your workforce. And for the paper with Matt and Chris, we had done some sort of back of the envelope calculation that in a colony that's very active, with a lot of foraging, it can be up to 20% of the colonies trapped in these structures at any one time, because there's lots of these different bridges along a trail. So it's a significant cost. But if we come back to that thing, right? The bridge actually is not going to build all the way to the end. It's going to stop somewhere in the middle. And where it stops actually depends on how narrow is that deviation, right? And then we can, in that paper actually, we do a calculation. We show that where it stops sort of balances the costs of the number of ants that you have trapped in that structure with the benefit you gain in terms of shortening the trail. Does that make sense? And so, but then you have to compound these benefits and these costs across the entire trail system. So you can't just focus on that one and say, oh, it's not worth it. You have to compound this over the entire system. Where were you? We were here, right? Hysteresis. Let's go back to that. Now, hysteresis, for those of you that have done a little bit of engineering, maybe, when you see hysteresis, you're usually very happy, because hysteresis is usually associated with systems that are capable of absorbing variation in there, in the environment, right? Your thermostat, for instance, in your house doesn't immediately react to a change in temperature. Usually it will wait until the temperature gets above a certain level before it starts cooling it down, or wait until it's below a certain level before it starts heating it up again. And that avoids that your heating or cooling system turns on and off systematically, losing a lot of energy. So a lot of engineering systems that deal with dynamical environment have hysteresis built in to absorb these phase variation. Now the question is, how is that hysteresis created by the ants? Well, it's a bit complicated to explain how we got to that, but essentially, remember that idea of packing density, this idea that you pack some number of ants in the bridge, and we can actually see that if you calculate the probability of ants leaving or joining the structure, there is a point where these two probabilities match. And at this point, essentially, is the point around which the ant colony is trying to keep the packing density of the bridge. So around about 0.5 ants per centimeter of the gap. Okay. So now that we know that there is an ideal packing density, a sort of target that the colony is trying to stay around by trying, I'm not anthropomorphizing this, right? Not at all. We can then decide if you have a bridge that has a higher packing density, for instance, on that side, then that bridge has an excess of ants, if you want. And if you are on that side of the line, you have a deficit of ants in the bridge. So the bridge needs more ants on the left of that line, or needs more ants on the right of that line. And we can then look at this deficit excess and how it affects that number of joining and leaving event. And so that's this blue and red curve here. And you can see that the blue and red curves around the zero are not exactly symmetrical. More exactly, the number of joining event is a little flatter, if you want, with the deficit, with the change in deficit, than the number of leaving event. And that non-symmetry between this is what creates that little delay, that hysteresis in the process. And that delay, that hysteresis, we can add it back into our model, essentially as a reaction to that excess. Now, the way ants sense the excess is something that is not completely clear, whether they sense, for instance, that they have locally less physical stress is one possibility, because the weight of the structure is weighing on them. Another thing is that in the earlier studies that we noticed is that an ant that is more inside the structure, for instance, is going to be gripped by more ants around it, so it can't leave. So physically, it's prevented from leaving, while the ants that are on the outside of the structure are less likely to be gripped by other ants, and so can leave more easily. But in any case, right, the ants are capable of sensing this excess or this deficit of ants, and using that measure can regulate that probability of leaving, okay? And introduce that little delay in their leaving rate, which then create that hysteresis. Now, to check whether hysteresis was actually helping in stabilizing the bridge, we did a virtual experiment. So these are models The two models on the left, the two control models, are models where there is no hysteresis, right? That probability is symmetrical on both sides. And this is a model that contains that asymmetry that generates the hysteresis. And the experiments that we did is a very simple experiment, a virtual experiment, where we have these bridges, these gaps. And instead of increasing them at a constant rate, we actually vibrate them, right? So we increase, shrink, increase, shrink, increase, shrink. So we subject the bridge to a lot of, wind or vibration, etc. And you can see that the models that don't contain the hysteresis are sort of all over the place. You have a lot of the bridges completely collapse, go to zero, and no ends are present inside the structure, so the bridge is completely dysfunctional. Some bridges end up with a huge amount of ends in the structure, so a lot of waste, if you prefer. But the model that contains hysteresis has two interesting properties. First, you don't have as many excessive large bridge, so you don't waste as much energy if you want. And no bridge ever collapses completely. So all the bridge maintain their function throughout the experiment. And we repeated this with multiple types, like stronger, weaker variation, etc. That is a general property. Of course, if you have too much noise in the system, at some point everything breaks. But given a certain amount of noise, your bridges are going to be more stable over time and be able to maintain their homeostasis without wasting too much energy. Now, this is essentially, the final picture after, that depends when you start counting, 12 to 20 years of work on these ends. And I have not talked at all about these big guys from the beginning. I only talked about very small structures because these are the easiest to observe and the easiest to quantify the behavior of the ants in. But we recently started a project funded by the NSF in collaboration with Northwestern University to actually study them. And in particular, so this is led by my postdoc, Isabel Muratore, these are images. So collecting ants in the field is essentially, we have this massive vacuum cleaner for army ants. Well, you still get bitten and they still don't like it, but it's better than doing it by hand. Trust me, I've tried to do it by hand. Didn't go well. We can then bring these ants that we collected in the field toward the field station of BCI, where they have small labs. And then we can connect these buckets full of ants to these observation chambers that are transparent buckets if we want. And inside these observation chambers, the ants naturally start forming these bivouacs, start attaching to each other and form these larger structures. In here, there's about, between 5,000 and 10,000 ants in here, just by weight. And then they will form this spontaneously. And the good thing as well is that if you disturb them, they will reform a new one over and over again until they run out of gas. Okay, so it's a nice system where we can actually start making measurement on these structure. But how do you measure these structures? Well, we build with the help of Petra Swissler and Mike Rubinstein at Harvard. They help us build that field CT scanner. So this machine, this Mad Max looking thing, actually contains an X-ray source and X-ray detector. We can put the ants on a rotating platform in front of it. So we can rotate that in front of the X-ray sensor and detector. It doesn't look great. It weighs a ton. It costs a ton of money to ship there. But once we have done the scanning, we can start getting a really, really nice three-dimensional representation of these structures, not only at the end of the build, but we can also measure this at different period of the build. So we can look at how the structure develops over time. And now that we have a preprint out, I can show you the results finally, because I could not do this until recently. And these are some of the results you'll see in the preprint. The first thing is, from left to right, it's earlier to later time of the construction process. The first thing that you'll notice is that in earlier time, the structure is extremely dense. These white area are actually empty areas inside. So the structure is extremely dense with very little empty spots. And as you grow the structure essentially hollows itself out from the inside. And more of these chambers are appearing, especially toward the center of the structure. Okay. So that's the first interesting results. These are structures that are built essentially by aggregating ants on the outside. And then when the structure is stable enough, the inside can start dismantling itself to create these hollow pockets in which the brood, the queen, can be stored safely. Another thing that we notice, and that to come back to your question, Blair, is if you take a slice of the ants, right, you look at the number of ants you have in this slice, and you're looking at the weight that that structure is carrying, so this slice is carrying all these guys below, and you look at so the relationship between the number of ants in that slice and the number of ants they are carrying, and you go from, so the graph I should exactly explain, this is zero means you are the top here, and then the further you go this way, the more you go down the structure, okay? What you can see here is that essentially there is a sort of maximum carrying capacity that is achieved by the ants, and they never really go above that. So they carry about eight, each ant at every level of the structure carries about eight ants below it, which seems a lot. You could not carry eight human beings, but it's not that much actually for the ants. Again, exoskeleton is great. But what's important here is that the structure is built so that they don't break through that barrier at any time. Now, this was done with a nice round disk, right? So we give them essentially the possibility to form that conical structure that has that ideal property. Experiments that Isabella has done this year, we don't have the result yet, has been done with attachment structure that have different shapes to like smaller disks, larger disks, or no disks, or crosses, or whatever. I forgot what she tested exactly. But that will allow us to look at how they deal with a situation in which they can't build that ideal conical structure. And now the step that we are working on is trying to see if we take that conceptual model, right, of I attach when it's difficult to move, I detach when I'm not in use, and I modulate my detachment rule based on whether or not locally I sense that I'm needed or not, whether it's enough to actually reproduce these structures. I don't have this result yet because I haven't run the model yet, but hopefully by next year when I come back, because Ian, you're gonna invite me next year again, right? I will be able to show you these results. But I'm gonna just let you with like, what is my favorite video of all times, until the next one, I guess. I should say like, this is the level of details we can get with that scanner. It's a makeshift scanner, but we can get really that level of details. What limits us is actually not the weird machine we have in the field, is how many graphics cards we can get our hands on, because these reconstructions are just ginormous. They are like billions and billions of voxels. And in reality, when we do analysis on something that is a lot less well-defined than that, because otherwise we would be we'll be still running this analysis as we speak. Thank you very much. And if you have any question, I'm here until tomorrow afternoon, so I have plenty of time.
Great talk. So obviously the bivouacs are nests, and so they have a queen as well as eggs and food. Have you seen, like, for these models, I guess I couldn't really identify, like, if there's larvae or if they have food in there.
Yeah,
but
so
how does that influence what's going on?
We are limited a little bit by the protocol we have with BCI. We are not supposed to X-ray the queen. So the queen is the reproductive elements of the colony, so obviously you don't want to bombard it with X-rays. Though the amount of X-rays they get is about the same thing as you would get at the dentist if you get like a full panorama of your mouth, so it's not deadly, and most of the workers only live a few months anyway, so it's not a big problem. But the queen, you don't want to irradiate the queen, because that the queen can live several years, and we don't want to have like a fluorescent army ants through the forest or monster stuff. So we have one example where we couldn't catch a queen. We saw the queen wasn't there, but it was inside, and we caught it after. I can show you some of the images after, but we can see it. We can reconstruct the queen inside. And it was located somewhere in the top part, which is something we know from traditional observations from before. Brood, we have also one colony where we have the brood, and it's actually, the brood is going to be when I showed you where the empty parts were, like that central colon, the brood is going to be occupying the top of that central colon usually. I mean, in that one scan we have, I shouldn't say usually, it's that one scan we have. But we're not supposed, BCI is kind enough to let us do this kind of weird stuff on the island. So we're not supposed to irradiate the brood or the queen. So we try to avoid that when we can.
Thank you. Such a great talk. And I'm always very jealous of people who work in systems where they're so tractable for these kind of experiments.
It's your fault. You chose the wrong system. Like, you can't say you're jealous. You made the wrong choice.
I know. Funnily enough, my very first research project when I was an undergrad in Cambridge Zoology Department was on ants and some these kinds of swarming questions. But anyway, I had some questions about your conceptual figure that you kept putting up, the ontogenesis. So, as I understood it, is that a figure of supposed to be a longitudinally across an individual's lifespan?
So you mean the the idea is these structures, right? They are born, they have to maintain homeostasis for a certain time, and then they have to die or disappear.
Right, and so what you've got is you had like function on the y-axis. So it's of it's of the superstructure. It's not of an individual animal.
No, it's of the superstructure, right? Right, the structure starts. There's a gap or something difficult to walk through, and the structure is started by that. And as it grows, it increases its function in the sense that it increases the ability of other ants to cross that particular substrate, and it has to maintain that ability for a certain amount of time. And then once that structure is not needed anymore, when the traffic of the colony dies, for instance, because it's the end of the foraging period or because there's nothing at the end of that foraging trail, then the structure has to dismantle itself. So it's not exactly ontogenesis like in the way traditionally you understand it, because there's no reproduction involved in there.
Right.
And we're talking about the ontogenesis of a structure within a larger society, if you want.
Right. But so you're using homeostasis to mean maintenance of the kind of prime
function.
Period of the structure.
Yeah. And they have to be able to do this despite the fact that the environmental conditions, both the status of the colony might change during that time, and that's controlled by the amount of traffic on the trail, but also the substrate on which they construct may be changing or being modified as they build. And so the question was trying to figure out, do they just like let it go and then build somewhere else, or do they actually try to absorb some of that variation? One thing I didn't talk about because I didn't have the time, but the traffic on the trail is extremely variable as well. It's funny, for some reason, there's a 3-second period. It seems to be oscillating with a 3-second period, not sure why. Maybe that was the work you did. That was the work Edward did. And they actually are absorbing also that predictable variability of the traffic. And so they don't react. They don't start deciding to leave before a few seconds, which is allow them to essentially keep the bridge active, despite the fact that the traffic might be oscillating very quickly. But as soon as it's longer than that short period of time, then they react to change in traffic extremely quickly.
So the terminology that you're using conceptually in that figure is the same terminology as like the life history and aging literature, right?
Exactly.
Like, so development, senescence,
and homeostasis.
And these kind of concepts. Is that deliberate then? Are you deliberately taking kind of like the life history? Terms and concepts and trying to apply them to super organisms.
Yeah, I mean, so the idea is often when we talk about collective behavior, as I said, a lot of work is done on the evolution of collective behaviors. So that part is covered a lot. A lot of is done on, you know, this immediate causation of the structure. So like, you know, most of the work that's done in collective behavior about rules of behavior, etc. But sort of looking at how the behavior is originated, maintained during its life, and actually finishes, because all this collective behavior at some point have to finish. Like a flock of birds doesn't flock forever. A school of fish doesn't school forever. At least my feeling is that we don't necessarily look at that whole life history of the collective structure as often. And so I'm trying something new, if you want. And it's also related to a grant we applied recently, and maybe I've gotten, I don't know yet, where we're looking at this from an energetics point of view, and how, as the colony grows in size, how its energetics demand changes, but how it adjusts to that energetic demand. And same thing when the colony starts senescing, how does that impact, for instance, foraging behavior, etc.
Thank you.
Does that make sense?
So you showed us a nice behavior rule of stopping when there's adversity and then anchoring for the inclination yep. experiment. Have you tested the same rule in bridge forming or ultimately yeah. the nest?
Yeah, so that's what I was trying to say a little earlier. Right, so this is the, you look at the probability of joining as a function of the packing fraction of the bridge. So the packing fraction is the number of ants that are already occupying that empty space. So the more ants are in the empty space, the easier it is to cross the gap. Right, it's like if you prefer, you have a hole in front of you and you fill it with sand, the more sand there is in the hole, the easier it is to cross the hole.
I see. So
the packing fraction is that. So when the packing fraction is high, you have a very low constraint on your movement. When the packing fraction is low, you have a high constraint because you have a gap in front of you that slows you down.
I see.
And so that's the same thing, right? The higher the constraints, the higher the probability of joining. Okay. So in bridge, and so I was trying to say, maybe I wasn't clear, but in bridge and in scaffold formation, mm-hmm. it's the same sort of general principle. It's hard to walk, it's hard to cross that triggers the construction behavior in the first place.
I see, thank you. Do you think that applies to the nest as well?
That's a great question. So one of the things is that they build this nest from the top down. So there is certainly something that's going to be different, right? Because they do not, it's not like a structure that they build to go over some sort of obstacle. So the initiation of the nest may not be triggered by exactly that kind of behavior. However, like the construction itself, right, the ants are, when they start building these chains, the ants are really streaming down. So there's a lot of traffic along the outside of the structure, and which will, you know, match that idea. If there's a lot of traffic walking, like passing next to me, I'm just going to stay put in the structure. But once the structure build, the inside of the structure, there's no traffic anymore. You're just hanging to other individuals. Yeah. You might feel as well that you're not the physical stress that was on you disappear little by little because there's more support structure around you, and then they may detach and form these open pockets inside. So origin of the construction of the behavior may be different. Mm. The rest, we think that conceptual model will still function in that case.
Right. Thank you.
No problem.
Hi.
Hi.
The nest and the X-ray. Reconstruction of it really reminds me of Orit Pelik's work on the honeybee swarm, nest.
Well, they just put out a preprint where they use, they have a different, I think they use a slightly different scanning method, but yeah.
My question is, have you also tried shaking the nest like they did?
Not yet. So the experiments where they shake the nest, they can't do the X-ray at the same time, right? Because the problem of the X-ray, it's you need the structure to, you know, not move, because it takes about a minute to scan the entire structure. So we haven't tried to shake the nest, at least not yet. Also, I'm going to let this to Orit. If Orit wants to come and work with us on shaking the nest, I'd be happy to collaborate with her. Right now, we're more interested in what happened after. Once the structure is forming, where are the ants attaching, in particular where they are detaching from? So how do you maintain that integrity of a shell when you start removing parts of it? And so that's the what Isabella has been working on by looking at different attachment substrate shapes. When you force them to go out of that ideal conic shapes where you can really support, I mean, that's the, from an engineering point of view, it's a great shape to support a lot of weight. Once you force them to not build like this, and in nature they don't build like this often. I mean, you see them, they form all sort of different structure. I mean, you've seen like the one I showed you, sort of like cathedral of ants. So the question is going to be, will they also start emptying out the inside the same way they do it in the conic shape, etc. So I'm looking more at we're looking more at the behavioral aspect, less at the physical aspect like Orit does. Part of the reason as well, and I should have mentioned that, is the goal of that project is to take what we learned from the behavioral rules of construction in the ants and put this in this crazy robots that Mike is building that are called, let's forget about this, but he built these robots that are capable of attaching to each other in all sort of configurations. And the idea is to build a sort of a smart swarm capable of constructing in any type of terrain, because that's one of the things these ants are really good at. It doesn't matter what terrain you give them, what constraints you give to them, they're capable of building something. And Mike is really interested in using that for his robot. But you should invite Mike. Great robot.
I also have a second question, if there's time, on one of the figures you showed on the toting platform.
Yeah.
The 60-degree panel showed, it looks like there are two stable faces.
Oh, well.
I was curious about that.
Yeah, so you mean like, this was one experiment, I think, and with the model fit to it. And during one experiment, like the traffic varies, right? You don't control a lot of things. The only thing you control is the tilt of that platform, essentially. So it's possible that during that experiment, the traffic died down a bit or slowed down or increased suddenly and you got a spike and then it stabilized. So if you look at all the figures, you see a lot of these, it looks like there is like plateaus and whatever, but it's often controlled by things that we have no control over. So in particular, the amount of traffic on the trail.
Thank you.
Can I do these questions first? Okay. So we have two questions.
I have to read it before answering
the question. So the first one from Elder. I was wondering if you implemented a machine learning algorithm such as a 3D unit for the city image segmentation, or did you have to do it manually? Right now it's done manually. We're just setting up a threshold based on a measure that we do on the density of the ant. So we can estimate how dense an ant is, especially in the first time of the scanner where we have very few ants in there, and then we use that to calibrate the threshold. But if you have a really great machine learning algorithm to automatically segment this huge amount of data, you have my email address. And then Carlos Munoz, how mobile are ants in a bivouac? Is it static when it's built? So some of them are very static and don't move. They are like attached and hanging there. And like in the bridges, they may stay there for hours without moving. But inside and outside the bivouac, it's extremely mobile. You have ants moving all the time. And you have also ants moving inside once these structures are open. On some of the scans, actually, you can, if you set the threshold properly, you can actually see a location where there seems to be some sort of a stream of blur, right? And that blur is indicating actually ants that are moving. So we can, to some extent, estimate where inside the structure there is movement if we wanted to. It's not super precise, but it's there is movement for sure. It's a very dynamical structure.
Yeah, hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, great. As you said, it's a dynamical structure. So regarding that, you say an ant is roughly carrying 7x its weight, right, in the structure?
So in the structure, we estimate that on average, right, no ant is carrying more than 8 times its own weight.
Huh. Are we sure? Is that an accurate measure? Because it's a dynamic structure, what happens is like they'll be.
It's an average measure, right?
Handing off each other's loads because they're moving around. So they're handing off. So.
No. So it's an average estimate at the moment. We're looking at just a layer and what's below it.
Yeah.
It's not possible right now for us to measure precisely that load, but we could technically, right? Because if we were capable of resolving the legs of the ants and like the actual attachment structure, right? So essentially, if someone can give us tons of graphics cards so we can get the maximum resolution out of that, we should be able to some extent reconstruct what is attached to what and then do some sort of estimate of the load and how it distributes through the structure. We haven't done that because what we realistically can work with is these low resolution scans that don't allow us to, low resolution reconstruction that don't allow us to get that level of
detail. It'll be important for your robotic simulations because if you go on the premise at 7x for its density.
Yeah, so one of the things we're going to be.
By the way, it's great.
Yeah, one of the things we're going to be doing is more traditional type of experiments where we look at them in 2D construction hives and looking essentially at the early stages of the construction process. So we can start looking at how they attach to each other inside the structure and how on small structure the weight might be distributed. Because in this case, you can potentially measure like the amount of weight that you have throughout the structure. But on this big one, the nice video that I showed you, we had to find someone very nice at Siemens who lended us a lot of his time and a lot of his computing power to reconstruct that very high definition reconstruction, But the one we work with are much, much smaller for just practical reasons. Also, graphics cards are very expensive nowadays.
NVIDIA has a program where they can...
Well, the thing is, right, like, the question is, do we need this for the questions that we are answering right now? I don't think we need that, but like later, if we start wanting to measure, for instance, very precisely things, then that's something we'll look into. We have also, I mean, our university also has like a graphics card clusters.
Well, thanks very much, Simon. It's been wonderful. And
you'll
be around, as he said, till tomorrow afternoon. So if anyone would like to arrange a meeting, email me, email Simon,
yeah,
we can set something up.
Yeah. Thank you very much.